Welcome to Mysterious Goings On. Glad to have you listening in. Hey, this week I want you to set the controls for something a little different. We're talking with an author who, like one notable filmmaker, has entertainingly mined a rich vein of tragic pop culture in his debut novel, Set the Controls for the Heart of Sharon Tate. Our guest is Gary Lipman. He was born and raised in New Jersey. He received a law degree from Northwestern University and has worked with New York's Innocence Project. Lipman's play, Paradox Lust, ran off-Broadway for a month in 2001, and his writing has been published in the New York Times, Paris Review, Vice, Fodor's, and many, many other places. His visual art can be seen at apocalypse.com, and we'll have all those links in the show notes, but I want to just welcome Gary Lipman to the show. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this trippy, suspenseful foray into the world of Sharon Tate fetishes. Wow.
Well, thank you. Trippy and suspenseful are two of the factors I was going for.
Oh, good.
Two of the adjectives I'm happy to have attached to it.
You know, I know you're probably, I don't know if you're happy or cringy when you hear people comparing constantly to Once Upon a Time, the new Quentin Tarantino film, because you probably had the idea, obviously, for this book years and years ago. Is that a fair statement?
That's very fair. In fact, I would change years to decades.
Wow.
30 years ago, 3 decades ago, I first hatched the idea for my book about someone who's obsessed with Sharon Tate, fully knowing that she's unavailable to ever meet or know, but is just obsessed. And I had the idea, and I got drawn into this fictive concept of celebrity pop culture obsessives, and especially dead celebrities, and what that could say about society. And even though I had the idea 30 years ago, it seems like it's just as or more pertinent to the times now that we live in.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, just 30 years ago, I had the idea, but I should add that I didn't really do too much with it. I began sketching out the concept, but I never really worked on it until a few years ago when I set to work with a new fervor and wrote it.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that with you in a moment. I want to talk a little bit about those origins, but maybe we should kind of just give a little capsule of what this wild ride's about. Do you mind sharing a little bit about what's going on in this great book?
Not at all. Not at all. I'm happy to. The basic story is a guy, as I say, is an obsessed fan of Sharon Tate. He's been that way since an early childhood experience where he saw her on TV in a movie rerun and fell in love, but then realized to his horror that she was a murder victim, a famous murder, infamous murder victim. Murdered, of course, by the minions of Charles Manson. And so my protagonist, goes out to Hollywood and stays in a hotel where Sharon Tate had once stayed. And he's there for two reasons. One is to finish a book he's writing about her, a book in her voice, where he's imagining her telling her own story. And that book is excerpted in my novel. And so you learn a lot about Sharon Tate's life and learn a lot about what a really intriguing and wonderful person she was. My protagonist is also staying out in Hollywood at this hotel to await the arrival of his fellow Sharon Tate fans. I kind of invented, although by now I think they actually exist, these Sharon Tate obsessives. So I invented this sort of cult community of right. Sharon Tate fans who call themselves Sharonophiles. And they love her. They know everything about her. They have their own fanzines and they talk to each other. And they also are unified, as you'd imagine, in their hatred of Charles Manson and everything he stands for. And my protagonist also really doesn't like Roman Polanski, mainly out of jealousy, because Polanski, of course, the famous or truly infamous Polish film director, was married to Sharon Tate at the time of her murder. So my protagonist is out there and he has the misfortune of running into a lot of really crazy Hollywood types, including a group of people who, much to his chagrin, are equally as obsessed with Charles Manson as he is with Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
So that's a bad match. And the badness of that match plays out as the book goes on.
Yeah. And I And I've read through quite a bit and looking into that, and you're talking about the lead, the protagonist, Lund. His, now, this is this jumped out at me, and there's a line here I'll just, if you don't mind me quoting, it's, before Lund had ever heard of Sharon Tate, his life was already linked with hers, more specifically with her death. This was because, unbeknownst to either of them at that time, Lund's sixth birthday, the 8th of August in 1969, was the same day the Manson family slaughtered Sharon. And then you go on, in fact, they did this an hour past midnight, thus technically August 9th, but Lund always ignored this inconvenient detail, savoring as he did any link to his beloved. I want to tell you something from a personal standpoint when that jumped out at me. I was born the exact day Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Tells you how old.
Oh, wow.
Right. And I also had a brief career in politics, right? And I always kind of channeled a little bit of Bobby in what I was doing. And I got to admit to you, Gary, for a while there, I probably got a little weird about it. But there is this weird thing. You're talking about it earlier about people who, it's macabre, but we get these almost fetish, well, some people are fetishizing the dead this way, but it's this weird hero worship and this cut down in the prime of life and this horrific murder that all seems to push some people's buttons in a certain way.
Yeah, exactly. And I should add that even though my novel's almost completely made up, as fiction writers do, we use little grace notes from our own lives. So I should add that I was born on that day. I used that birthday. So I had that connection to Sharon Tate. She was killed on my, basically on my sixth birthday. So I used that. And I also used the one other really autobiographical factor here is the fact was that I was my protagonist. I was a kid of about 10 watching TV one night when I saw Sharon Tate on TV and fell in love, and then realized when the credits to the film rolled. And that film I saw, by the way, that night when I was a kid was The Wrecking Crew, the Dean Martin movie with Sharon Tate, yeah, which is in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right, featured pretty prominently. Not a great movie, but fun. And it shows Sharon Tate to great effect, because she really was, I think, a talented comedian. I don't know that she ever would have been a really successful dramatic actress, though she might have been, but she had a really refreshing manner and comic sense and charm, kind of a Daffy charm in that film. And I think she probably could have become a sort of America's sweetheart in the vein of Julia Roberts or Meg Ryan. Emma Stone, if she'd gone on to continue acting, and I think she would have found that niche had she been allowed to live.
Yeah, she was only 26, correct, when she was
right. Older. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So I mean, that's just the dawn of your life, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think she was a pretty from all the research I did, and I try to convey this in my novel. She was a pretty special person. Apart from her extraordinary physical beauty, she was a caring, thoughtful, pretty bright, and even rather wise person. So she was really special. I did not go on to be obsessed with her, but I got the idea years later when I was a young man. I was in a bar and I saw the bartender looked familiar to me, and I thought, you know, beautiful bartender, and I was looking at her and thinking, why does she look familiar? And then it hit me that she looked like Sharon Tate. So I got thinking about what it would be like to be someone who looked like Sharon Tate, or to date someone who looked like Sharon Tate. And as I began ruminating on that, I had the idea to write this novel. I thought, you know, what if someone was obsessed with Sharon Tate? And then very shortly thereafter, I had the idea, well, what would happen, you know, as we spin ideas for fiction, asking what if? I thought, what if that Sharon Tate lover, obsessive, bumped into Charles Manson lovers? You know, that would, as I said before, be a very profoundly bad match. And so that gave me the idea for this. You know, you want to have conflict. So there was a conflict right there, the inherent conflict of loving someone who's gone you know, as he does Sharon Tate, and also the conflict, the external conflict of meeting people who revere her murderer. So I was off to the races with the idea, but I didn't finally sit down and really write it in earnest until many years later.
Yeah, that kind of matter and antimatter coming together for the protagonist, that's powerful.
Right, well put, yeah. That's a great metaphor for it, yeah.
Well, so you kind of launched right into my next question then, and we'll come back a little bit more to the book in a moment, but I want to ask you, you're a lawyer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, not practicing at the moment, but I have worked for many, many years at the Innocence Project in New York.
That is the most noble work. That is the most noble,
work. Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, of course, we would represent people who were already imprisoned, convicted of violent crimes, usually rape or murder, but who really argued that they were innocent. And when we agreed to take the case, thinking they might have something, we would get DNA checked out. And very often, I mean, it's in the hundreds now, the people that have been exonerated fully by DNA evidence. When there was no DNA angle, the Innocence Project would recommend other resources for the people. It's done amazing work. It was a privilege to work there, and I hope to go back there sometime.
Were you actually involved as a trial lawyer or part of the team?
I was. They do appellate work.
Trial is appeals, right? That's right.
Yes. It's appeals, right? Because people are already convicted, so they would write to us typically and say, "Do we? You know, I'm innocent. Get me out of here," basically. Right. And so, if there was a DNA component, we would take the case if we believed it was compelling and it seemed like there was real factual innocence involved there, not just the legal technicality, et cetera, at the trial level. So we would take the case if it seemed the person was innocent, because we're pro bono.
Right.
We really would take cases when the person did seem to have a pretty good claim to being innocent. And the work I did was taking the file, getting into the details of the file and writing memos and deciding whether or not to go forward with the case. I wasn't at the appeals court arguing it. There were other lawyers who would do that. And it was pretty interesting, especially as a writer of fiction and a reader of fiction, to go through these files and try to determine. It was almost sometimes like reading a whodunit, except in real life, you know, because these were serious crimes and real victims, real perpetrators. And sometimes cases were pretty glaring that the person was innocent. Sometimes you weren't sure. And there were a few cases I still think about and wonder what was really going on there. You know, they were kind of really ambiguous, whether the person was innocent or not, or what really happened there.
When I was a working journalist, I toured a federal correctional facility and got to interview several inmates. And one thing that the warden said before he let me in there, he said, "I need you to understand something. Everybody in here is innocent. Everybody in here is going to tell you they're innocent. And they're going to ask you as a journalist, maybe look into their case or something like that." And I remember that. And I, you know what? Almost everybody I spoke to said, "I'm innocent." So you had to sift through that. And that's why where the DNA comes in. It's like, okay, DNA is factor. It's either there or it's not, right? So
right. Well, yes, usually that's the case. And let's hope going forward into the future, with the increasing prevalence of DNA testing, that the Innocence Project won't be needed as much, or other Innocence Projects. I worked at the one kind of the main, one of the first, or the first, and one of the main ones in New York City, but they exist all over the country now. And let's hope in the future that they're not as needed, because DNA testing will be done at the trial level.
Ah.
Many of these men, these convicts who are our clients, and it usually almost always is men, not always, but often, many of them never got they've been in so long that they never got the benefit of DNA testing initially.
Right.
Or it was done in a kind of shoddy way, or the files were lost, or you know, any number of things that were either accidents or bad behavior by the prosecutor. Or in some cases, defense attorneys didn't do their job and insist on it, or et cetera. So, but going forward, I think DNA, the odds are in the favor of innocent people in that DNA testing will be done more and more and accepted more and more. And it's becoming so much more accepted. So I think that's good going forward. What are heartbreaking are the cases where there's no DNA evidence, you know, like a shooting where the shooter doesn't leave behind any DNA evidence. And so it's that much harder to exonerate the person if they are in fact innocent.
Yeah. So you did an off-Broadway play also.
Yeah, I did. It was actually a vague, I sometimes say off-Broadway because it was sort of a theater that was in a kind of back then in 2001, sort of a weird hinterland between off-Broadway and off-Broadway. There were people involved with the production who said it qualified as off-Broadway. Others said just off-off. And for listeners out there, that really matters to the theater community in New York.
Yeah.
So regardless of how you characterize it, it was a comedy, very different from the novel I published about Sharon Tate and Sharon Tate Obsessives. And yeah, that was fun. I love writing for the stage. I've done a few plays since that. One had a staged reading and another I just finished. And that involves a murder.
Oh.
And so, yeah, that one's a little more, it's not a noir or crime thriller per se, this new play, but it does involve a murder and the repercussions from it. And so I love writing for the stage, and maybe even I find it more enjoyable than even writing fiction. It's less stressful. Because you have less, I mean, it's more demanding in some ways because you have to tell the story exclusively through
dialogue
and stage directions, right? Yeah. But somehow that having those limitations makes it a little, it focuses you more, you know, it focuses the storytelling instinct. With fiction, you're, of course, you know, the sky's the limit. You have to, you can deal with thoughts, physical description, weather, you know, you have to really describe in elegant ways, people walking in and out of rooms,
yeah.
You know, so sex scenes.
Oh.
My novel has two sex scenes. And so that was interesting to write. I don't think I'd ever done that before. I mean, I'd had sex, but I never wrote about it. Or maybe I never have had sex, but I just want to say I did so your podcast audience thinks I did. I do have a child, though, so so I could point to him as evidence.
I love what you're saying, besides that being terribly funny, but I love what you're saying, though, about, I mean, because you've got this, your toolbox, your paint box, if you will, and as a fiction, with prose and with, you know, writing a novel, you've got, like you said, you can use thoughts, you can do all these other things, but on the stage, exactly, you have stage direction and dialogue. This is it. I'm kind of going through that right now. I'm just as an exercise, I have no hopes whatsoever of selling them. I'm trying to combine a couple of my suspense novels into a screenplay just for fun, just to see. And that's exactly right. It's very similar there for a screenplay as well, I assume.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I guess I've never written a screenplay, but I think that sounds great. I mean, and you're combining more than one?
Yeah. I've got a series of seven right now, mystery thrillers. And it's kind of, one reason I really, by the way, love your stuff is that mine's kind of quirky, and I don't mean quirky in a dismissive way. Okay. Just a shorthand. It's kind of quirky as well. And it takes the detective novel, but he's not really a detective in the mystery novel. And they're really not great mysteries. It's just what I like to tell people is I like have interesting characters and mysterious situations. That's what I like to tell everybody.
That's all you need, man.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
So but you know what? Watching Knives Out is really kind of reminded me that I should probably try to do a little more drawing room, maybe have a little more fun, you know, with the mystery. So I'm working on that with my next one.
Well, I look forward to reading it and seeing it.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I think Knives Out is a great, I just saw Knives Out and I loved it.
It's, It's a question I often ask myself after I finish a book, and I wonder if this has crossed your mind, Gary. Let me just ask you. So when you got through a set the controls, have you ever sat back and you see the printed book on the table and thought, well, you know, that'd be a hell of a movie. Have you ever thought of that?
Of course. Well, especially because this book is set in Hollywood and it's about movie people. And I guess, you know, Alex, actually, I think that we've all been, I'm a little older than you, but, you know, we're both the same generation of people who came up with movies and TV so much that I can't help but think it's infiltrated our reading habits, you know. And so I, you know, I'm not sure if in writing my book, I wasn't influenced by the thought of, or writing it, if I didn't filter it through a kind of movie watching gene or scrim, you know, that I saw through, one thing that movies have done, of course, is the jump cuts, right? Scenes. And I can't help but think that when we write, especially write a mystery, for example, or a noir novel, I can't help but think that we don't maybe structure it, even if only subconsciously, as a film would look, you know, as a film would play out.
That's fascinating.
So, yeah, well, I think it may be. It's not something I did consciously, but maybe especially because my novel set in Hollywood,
right,
you know, that maybe that did influence me. And
I think it did. I think it did, from what I've read and just listening to you speak about it, Gary, is that there's one thing I can see already. And I did a little research on your play, your off-Broadway play, and humor and a playfulness with words obviously is something that clearly is part of your makeup. And I mean, I'm getting kind of an, from the read and everything, there's, and I'm not the first one to think this, obviously, because I just checked your, some of your reviews on the book on Amazon, which are great, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It kind of evokes an Elmore Leonard with a dollop of David Sedaris, you know, kind of thing here. And, you know, that's, I think that is just, for me, that's right up my alley. And I'm just telling everybody, all my listeners here who read my books, I think you're going to want to get Gary's books, because this is the stuff you're going to really enjoy. I also got kind of a, and I need to read more deeply, get into a little more, but I am blanking. I apologize. I've got this weird,
okay.
Johnny Depp played him in the movie with Benicio Del Toro as his sidekick.
Oh, Hunter S. Thompson.
Hunter S. Thompson. Thank you. I was seeing him and I'm just like, but I mean, it seems like there's this sideways skewed thing going on here at this Chateau Marmont type location. Is everything just a little skewed here, or am I off on that?
Well, thank you. It's funny you say Chateau Marmont. That was an inspiration for the hotel in my book, and funny too, because I was staying there once 20 years ago, and I was sitting at a table alone outside. It was nighttime. And they seated at the table next to me a big party, including Hunter S. Thompson and Johnny Depp.
No way.
And Thompson, he was holding court. I never met Thompson. I just had this one experience sitting next to him. But what was so funny, it was toward the end of his life, is he mumbled a lot. You know, he was kind of a mumbler. And he was speaking kind of quietly and sort of mumbling, or at least to my ears, it sounded like mumbling. So I was sort of eavesdropping, but I couldn't understand much of what he said. I wanted to, you know, check out, maybe some pearls of wisdom would fall from his lips and roll over to my table, but I couldn't really understand him at all. I've since gotten friendly with someone who was very, very close with him, who speaks really fondly of him. And of course, I've read a lot of his stuff and love it. And Elmore Leonard and David Sedaris as well. And for mystery writers, by the way, I'm sure people have seen this, but I actually briefly at a book signing met Elmore Leonard, who I adore. And I asked him for writing advice. And he told me some interesting advice, which, as I say, he may have said this in interviews. He probably did. It seemed kind of elemental. But he said to become a great writer, pick a favorite author. He, as I recall, he said the one of the authors he chose was Hemingway, and then type one of their books or two of their books. Simply start at the beginning and type it up, and then throw it out. You know, you've just typed a Hemingway book. But he said in the process of typing up another writer, a writer you admire, their work, you would begin to understand how they put it together.
Oh my God.
You know, and I think that's really interesting advice. I've never done it, but I have once or twice typed up either for a journalistic piece I did or something someone's writing. And it does give you a good look under the hood of how people get the effects that they do. Elmore Leonard, I'm honored to be mentioned in the same breath as Leonard. Sidaris, who's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's so interesting. Really quickly, our listeners will know that in 2018, my grandfather wrote Westerns and for over a 50-year career, right? And he passed away 15 years ago, but he'd left me all his papers. And going through his papers a few years ago, I found an unfinished Western. So I finished it. You know,
Oh, great.
I basically was just, you know, polishing up most of what he'd done, but then he'd left a few chunks that needed fixing, right? So did that. But then I wanted, just for fun, a Western writer in the 40s and 50s, he had a lot of stuff that was published in the pulps. And, you know, the old pulp fiction Western magazines, cowboys and on the cover and stuff like that, right?
So right.
They're not digital at all that I can find. So I found a copy on eBay of Ranch Romances from like 1954. He had about a 3,000 word story in this Ranch Romances. So I had to physically type it and enter it in to get it to be tacked onto the book. And I also had to like retype a bunch of his letters and things like that I wanted to add in just to make this kind of an omnibus of my grandpa, my final, you know, thing. So hearing what Elmore Leonard told you and thinking on that, I have to admit, I think I did gain some real insight on how he put words together. And
yeah,
that is good advice. So,
Yeah, I'm glad you did it. I mean, I've said that to a few people, but I never met anybody who did type up something at length as you have, other than Leonard, that I know of. So I'm glad, Alex, that you had that experience. So you could confirm you did learn something from it.
I did. I learned because I knew him very well as my grandfather and basically a friend to me. But I learned as a writer, I did get some ideas about how his structure worked and how he did dialogue.
And let me just say how beautiful I think that is that you finished your grandfather's work.
Oh, thank you.
That's great. Yeah.
Thank you. I tell people all the time, you know, I may never sell millions of books, and he didn't either. He was a mid-lister, strict mid-lister, but it was just an honor to know him, and it was an even greater honor to put my name in small type under his for one time in my life.
So, yeah, that's great.
Thank you
for
telling me that.
Of course.
So this is all coming together for me about Gary Lipman is, and I'm looking at excerpts and parts of the Sharon Tate book, and the dialogue is a hoot.
Thank you.
The phone calls and you couldn't meet a nicer group of people. One of the Manson family described that hippie kill cult. You know, these things like that. All these, not only is your dialogue sweet and fun, but I'm seeing a lot of what your research being pulled in here. You're pulling it all together. So I have to ask, structure wise, when you sit down to write this, do you kind of move through it, get as much of the story on paper as you can, and then do you go back and kind of populate that dialogue and punch it up and add in the historical notes, or is there an approach that you took that you'd care to share with us?
Sure. Well, I think that's a great question. I always think about that because I have friends who are writers who tell me that they begin work without knowing anything about the characters or story. They discover everything through the process of writing. And they just, very fine writers, one in particular, a novelist named Dahlia Sofer, who wrote a wonderful novel. It's not a mystery. It's a serious work of literary fiction, but a wonderful book called The Septembers of Shiraz. And it was made into a film with Adrian Brody and Salma Hayek. It's a book about revolutionary Iran. And Dahlia's told me that she sits for her new book, for example, and for that one, she just sits down and gets one little initial idea and starts writing and makes it up as she goes along. And then we'll do a second, third draft and make connections and eliminate some stuff and add some stuff and really bring it together that way. But the first draft for her and for other writers I know is really improvisational and spontaneous. I'm not like that. I need to know the end before I begin.
Really?
Yeah. So I sort of have a deal with myself that I outline it and kind of figure out the structure of the story. But my deal with myself is whenever I have a better idea, I just will change it, change the structure or change the plot to accommodate the new idea. And so I rewrote this novel a bunch of times and edited it. And it seemed to me that I was really, you know, discovering the story through the rewriting, and that was, you know, spontaneous. But the initial draft was not made up from scratch the way my friend, for example, does. My initial draft was structured with the ending, and the ending never changed. I always had that ending in mind even before I began writing. And the advantage of that for me, and I wouldn't say that this is how other people should write. It seems like everybody has their own style and their own methods. But for me, having that ending and knowing how it would end was something that I was driving toward, you know, and it gave me, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. I know I'm misusing that metaphor, but it was something to head toward and structure everything according to that ending, you know. So so that's how I did it. And almost, as I mentioned before, I had that initial idea 30 years ago of the Sharon Tate obsessive and then Charles Manson obsessives. And thinking about it, I think even back then, 30 years ago, before I even started writing, long before I started writing in earnest on it, I had the ending in mind, which never changed. But with other things I've written, the ending does change and you surprise yourself. With this book, for me, the ending was an organizing principle from the start.
Well, and from what I know about how it apparently wraps up, I can see why, and I can see how it couldn't really go any other way. So,
yeah. Well, you know, you always wonder. There's a great quote that I always think about. Someone said that the ending of a story, when you get to it, and this applies to every ending, you know, or every story, not just mysteries, where the ending is so important, of course. Well, endings are important in every story, right?
Right.
And the quote I heard that I think about a lot is a great ending should be surprising yet inevitable.
Yeah.
Where you're surprised, but then afterwards you think, you know what? Even though I was surprised, delightfully, one hopes, nevertheless, that's how it had to end. You know, that really is, if you think about the story in detail, that really is the best ending. And that is the ending that, to use that term, inevitable, is the one that it required, the story required. Of course, it's tough to discern what that is, and you may not even be totally sure about it. Have you found that with your endings, that you feel they were surprising yet inevitable?
Looking back, my debut, I look back at that, and I got to confess to you, Gary, because my mind's racing hearing you talk about this, and I was thinking, but in Pilots Cross, my first one, I always had that last sentence pretty well. That was how it was going to go down, but it was that last sentence that I always knew. I was like, I knew I always wanted, anyway, that particular sentence to go there, and now I'm looking at the others, and... You know, pardoning my own hackiness. I have kind of decided after a couple of books that it's going to be a series, so it's okay to almost cliffhanger some of these books. And I did do some cliffhanger stuff, and just to kind of keep the interest going. But if I was writing, I think if I was writing just a standalone again, I think I might be with you on that. I don't typically outline. because I was going to contest that with you and say yes, but I don't want to be hidebound. I don't want to be straitjacketed. I mean, by an outline. But you said it yourself. Well, if it's not working, I'll change it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's that. I guess you might say you're being flexible. You know, you're being determined yet flexible.
Right.
Right. It's finding that sweet spot between, you know, wanting the story to go a certain way. That's what got you into it, wanting you to tell the story, to tell this story. But recognizing that if your imagination leads you down other lanes, that you're going to follow it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, going where the characters take you often, too.
Yeah, I mean, there were, in spite of my structure, there were changes I made, you know, big changes where I thought, no, this is going to be this way. In fact, the ending, my ending, and no spoilers here, but I tried to make a really dramatic and meaningful ending, but and the gist of it has remained the same, as I said, since the beginning. But I did change it a bit to preserve a bit of sympathy for my protagonist. I felt like it was the kind of book where I didn't want to be, I'm pretty damning toward him, because I should say, I don't think it's and one moral of the book, if it has a moral, is that it's probably not a good idea to obsess over dead pop culture icons, right? That's right. Not going to lead to a healthy life, right? Best to not obsess too much about anything, you know, other than your health, maybe. But also, you know, to obsess about someone who's dead is not only, you know, unproductive, but also kind of disrespectful to that dead person, you know, to their memory, to their humanity. So that is a bit of a moral in my book. I have a critical view of my protagonist for having that that predisposition, and in a sense, the novel's a bit of an education for him to sort of move him a bit beyond that through all sorts of ways, many of them very unpleasant.
Yeah.
and of course, I have the same view, but doubly so for people obsessed with Charles Manson or other serial killers. But of course they exist, you know, they do exist out there. There are people, and I go into one section of the book where I talk about how Manson's very popular now. Now he's gone, of course, but still, you know, become a sort of punk rock icon. Not really punk rock, but sort of decadent anti-hero for right. A lot of people who are unhappy with society, and they choose to worship, they see as the ultimate person or rebel against society, a serial killer. Unfortunately, Manson was no deep thinker or moral arbiter of anything. He was a psychopath out for himself.
Yeah. There's so much of that in our discourse. I think we touched on that going on, is that there's people who would rather just blow everything up, you know.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And you look at some of the, and I know what you're getting at, I think, and you know, you see the popularity and this fixation on, well, even what I would say are arguably good shows like Mindhunter and things that examine how they track down these serial killers and these sociopaths and all these people, but ultimately, if there's not some revulsion for these people in you, if your gorge doesn't rise thinking about them too much, I think there's a problem. So I like that you imbued that with Lunt, that you kind of were like, look, buddy, this is not good.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you want your protagonist to change, right?
Right.
I mean, one thing I always heard about the TV comedy Seinfeld was Larry David and the other writers said that their kind of guiding ethos with the show was no lessons, right?
Right.
Nobody learns any lessons. And I think that, you know, that's cool. That's funny. I think that's true of Larry David's subsequent show, Curb Your Enthusiasm,
yes.
The comedy. You know, he's just the protagonist played by Larry David himself is just getting into one fine mess after another and learning nothing from it.
Right.
And that's cool too. That itself is making a point. It has a point to make, but, he, But for me, I realized with this book that I did have a kind of not a message or moral, but I just felt like the character needed to change and needed to learn something.
Right.
Maybe the next book I won't follow that pattern, you know, follow that ethos. But for this, it just seemed like I wanted to take him to a different place.
Well,
and so, yeah.
I think you're going to be taking readers to a different place. Everybody, you should set your controls for The Heart of Sharon Tate, a novel by Gary Lipman. Gary, where can they find this wonderful book?
Well, I have a website where you can order it, GaryLipmanOfficial.com. That's GaryLipmanOfficial.com. And Amazon, Barnes & Noble, it's at a lot of indie bookstores. And best of all are those indie bookstores. We need to support them, of course.
Amen.
And if you have a choice between Barnes & Noble and Amazon, I say go with Barnes & Noble, simply because they still have brick-and-mortar stores out there.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Real quick, anything on the horizon we should watch for after this one?
Sure. I'm working on a book of short stories, and I've got another novel ready to go, and which also has a noir kind of feel to it. But again, not a conventional one by any means.
Good.
And I'm looking forward to reading your stuff and having your screenplay that you're working on be made into a film.
How about this? If they buy my screenplay, I'll let them option it from me, but we'll have you rework all the dialogue. That sounds like a good deal.
I'd love to work with you, Alex. We have a good podcast thing going. Let's take it on further.
Well, and by the way, I extend an invitation. When that new book is out, have your guy get a hold of me, because we want to have you back if you've enjoyed
this.
Great,
I would love that.
All right, everybody. Again, this has been Gary Lipman, author, playwright, and all-around entertaining fellow. Thanks so much for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. And to you listeners, don't forget to check out all the show notes and the links to Gary's stuff on mgopod.com. We'll also post a teaser for the book. There'll be a lot more information there. You know, we just can't pack all that stuff into the feed, so you can go find it at mgopod.com. All right, I'm Alex Greenwood. It's been my pleasure to get in your ears yet again, and until next time, keep reading.
Hey, Mysterious Going On fans. Are you a fan of live music? If so, you'll want to check out my podcast, Trading Fours. I'm your host, Jamie Green. Trading Fours is a fun, casual conversation with Kansas City musicians. Join me as we find out what makes Kansas City such a special place for live music. You can find my podcast, Trading Fours, wherever you subscribe to your favorites.
It's a great time to get a great deal on a new car when you get approved for an auto loan from PenFed. Our Powered by True Car rates are as low as 1.39% APR on new vehicles. Finance for a longer term to lower your monthly bill. Plus, take up to 60 days to schedule your first payment. Join PenFed, and together, we'll keep you moving forward. Anyone can apply. Visit PenFed.org/auto or call 1-800-247-5626. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Get a credit card that gives you what you need now. A low interest rate on everyday purchases and a place to transfer high interest rate balances. The PenFed Gold Contactless Card is our lowest interest rate credit card. You can even earn a $100 statement credit when you spend $1,500 in the first 90 days. Join PenFed, and together we can help you keep more of what's yours. Visit PenFed.org/goldcard. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.